Welcome to the April 24th Easter edition of This Week in Palestine on WZBC 90.3 FM, a weekly show hosted for many years by our beloved Sharif Pham and continued in his loving memory by his friends. I am your host, Despina Mutzuris, and today's show features an excerpt of Omar Barghouti's recent talk at Harvard University on boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and the global struggle for Palestinian rights. Barghouti is a founding member of the Palestinian Civil Society Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Campaign, begun in 2005. Although initially denied a visa, Barghouti was successful in entering the United States to promote his new book, BDS, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights, which I strongly encourage all of you to read. Before listening to Barghouti explain the wider context of this struggle, however, I'd like to read a part of the original call issued in July 2005, which is as relevant today as it was 5 years ago, to remind us of the hard but necessary work that lies ahead to dismantle the unjust political, economic, and social system that binds both Palestinians and Israelis in a mutually destructive dance of death. I'd also like to read a part of the call as a reminder of the power of people to transform and dismantle unjust systems of power. The call demands, and I quote, "In light of Israel's persistent violations of international law, and given that since 1948, hundreds of UN resolutions have condemned Israel's colonial and discriminatory policies as illegal, and called for immediate, adequate, and effective remedies, and given that all forms of international intervention and peacemaking have until now failed to convince or force Israel to comply with humanitarian law, to respect fundamental human rights, and to end its occupation and oppression of the people of Palestine, and in view of the fact that people of conscience in the international community have historically shouldered the moral responsibility to fight injustice, as exemplified in the struggle to abolish apartheid in South Africa through diverse forms of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and inspired by the struggle of South Africans against apartheid, and in the spirit of international solidarity, moral consistency, and resistance to injustice and oppression. We, representatives of Palestinian civil society, call upon international civil society organizations and people of conscience all over the world to impose broad boycotts and implement divestment initiatives against Israel similar to those applied to South Africa in the apartheid era. We appeal to you to pressure your respective states to impose embargoes and sanctions against Israel. We also invite conscientious Israelis to support this call for the sake of justice and genuine peace. These nonviolent punitive measures should be maintained until Israel meets its obligation to recognize the Palestinian people's inalienable right to self-determination and fully complies with the precepts of international law by 1. Ending its occupation and colonization of all Arab lands and dismantling the wall. 2. Recognizing the fundamental rights of Arab-Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality. And 3. Respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties as stipulated in UN Resolution 194. And as you can see, that call is as relevant today as it was 5 years ago. And now I'd like to turn to Omar Barghouti's call at Harvard University. Thank you.
I'm very proud to speak at Harvard on BDS. I know it took a lot of work to get this happening, so I applaud the student groups and PSC and everyone who helped put this together. Thank you very much. One of Africa's most important contemporary writers, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, wrote in his book Decolonizing the Mind, about the ultimatum imperialism gives to the oppressed: accept theft or death. He says, "The oppressed and the exploited of the earth maintain their defiance, liberty from theft. But the biggest weapon wielded and actually daily unleashed by imperialism against that collective defiance is the cultural bomb. The effect of a cultural bomb is to annihilate a people's belief in their names, in their languages, in their environment, in their heritage of struggle, in their unity, in their capacities, and ultimately in themselves. It makes them see their past as one wasteland of non-achievement, and it makes them want to distance themselves from that wasteland. It even plants serious doubts about the moral rightness of struggle. Possibilities of victory are seen as remote, ridiculous dreams. The intended results are despair, despondency, and a collective death wish." End of quote. Rather than falling into despondency, despair, and this collective death wish, Palestinians have crossed the threshold of fear, as recently seen also Arabs have in many Arab countries, especially in Tunisia, Egypt, and elsewhere. So we're living in a moment that's extremely critical, extremely important, and for once, not that gloomy. We often start our speeches, we're living at a critical juncture where everything is so bleak and hopeless, and therefore we have to struggle. No, now we're living in a moment of real hope and irreversible transformations to the right side, finally. We're seeing real transformations in the Arab world. Israel is losing a lot of its past famed strategic service to Western imperialism. One of its main objectives was to suppress any possibility of Arab revolt so that the West can continue exploiting our resources. Well, it failed to do that. So what good is it? So that's an important question that will come up and is already coming up, and it's feeding the discourse and the debates in the U.S. establishment even about Israel's role in serving Western imperialism and especially serving U.S. Establishment's interest. This background, Israel's loss of the umbrella of Arab complicity, and the prospects of Arab governments becoming democratic, reflecting their people's opinions, which includes opposition to Israel's occupation and apartheid, will certainly feed the Palestinian struggle for self-determination and freedom. So the BDS movement is very inspired and emboldened by the Arab revolutions in the region. If we go back to the discussion about the cultural bomb that Ngugi so well talked about, Israel has focused on denying Palestinian existence in many, many ways, including by targeting our culture as such. An Israeli researcher, a PhD student at Ben-Gurion University, and he's a Jewish Israeli student, for your information, revealed that tens of thousands of Palestinian books that were stolen from Palestinian homes during the Nakba were destroyed, systematically destroyed by Israel. Others were pillaged and kept till now in Israeli universities. And this researcher said that Israel systematically destroyed those books to, quote, Judaize the country, end of quote. The point was to cut off Palestinians from their heritage and culture. So this researcher goes on to say that this was a cultural massacre undertaken in a manner that was worse than European colonialism, which safeguarded the items it stole in libraries and museums, ironically. Israel's suppression of Palestinian education and culture did not stop at the Nakba. It continued. Even in the First Intifada, which started in 1987, which was predominantly a nonviolent, peaceful protest, popular protest against Israel's occupation, Israel criminalized Palestinian education. Soon after the Intifada broke out, a few months after, Israel shut down all 6 Palestinian universities, all 13 colleges, and a few days after that, the Israeli radio announced that the army had ordered all 1,194 schools in the West Bank closed as well until further notice. Some universities like Bir Zeit were shut for 4 consecutive years. Students denied education completely. So Palestinian education went underground at that stage. Palestinian professors had to teach, and teachers had to teach in mosques, churches, community centers, homes, basements, away from the eyes of soldiers. If a child was caught carrying a textbook, he would be imprisoned. It was seriously criminalized. The entire education system was criminalized. In fact, on 19 April 1989, at the height of the Intifada, the Jerusalem Post reported that the Israeli police had, quote, and listen well, quote, uncovered a network of illegal classes held by West Bank universities at private high schools in East Jerusalem. So that was big news in the Jerusalem Post at the time. So when people discuss Israel's democracy, when they say, why boycott Israel when it's a democratic state? I know many in this room already know the answer, but for those who still need further convincing, and a state that occupies, a state that ethnically cleanses, a state that burns books or destroys them, and a state that continues its apartheid regime can never be a democracy. But Palestinians in Israel have the right to vote. Despite all the oppression and racial discrimination and so on, Palestinian citizens of Israel can vote. So here's what Ilan Pape, the famous Israeli historian, had to say about that aspect. He says, Israel is what we in political science call a Herrenvolk democracy, democracy only for the masters. The fact that you allow people to participate in the formal side of democracy, namely to vote or to be elected, is meaningless if you don't give them any share in the common good or in the common resources of the state, or if you discriminate against them despite the fact that you allow them to participate in the elections. Pape goes on to say, on almost every level, from official legislation through governmental practices to social and cultural attitudes, Israel is only a democracy for one ethnic group. End of quote. In this context, the BDS movement becomes a natural reaction to Israel's occupation, colonization, and apartheid. And I'll explain the apartheid term because it's not very well understood. The BDS call came out in 2005. A great majority of Palestinian civil society supported that call. And by Palestinian civil society, we don't just mean in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, including East Jerusalem, but also Palestinians in 48 inside Israel, citizens of the State of Israel, and most importantly, Palestinian refugees, the exilic community, who happen to be the majority of the Palestinian people. Since the Oslo Accords, signed between the PLO and the government of Israel, the definition of the Palestinian people was reduced by the hegemonic powers into just those in the occupied territories. So when you hear about polls saying 60% of Palestinians support this or are against that, they're talking about the West Bank and Gaza. They're ignoring that two-thirds of the Palestinians are not under occupation. The majority are refugees, and there's a small minority, about 1.3 million, who are citizens of the State of Israel. And even among the Palestinian citizens of Israel, you have about 300,000 internally displaced persons. Those who carry Israeli citizenship and were ethnically cleansed from their villages and cannot reclaim their property despite being citizens of the state simply because they're not Jewish. So you have a case like Ein Hod, a village near Haifa, where many of the people who were ethnically cleansed did not leave to Lebanon. They stayed and they created a kind of a refugee camp very close to their village, almost overlooking their village. And every day they wake up and see their beautiful houses. That was one of the few villages that was not destroyed. It was beautiful buildings. So they kept them and they turned it into an artist colony, a Jewish artist colony. So every day they see their houses occupied by those wonderful liberal Jewish Israeli artists, who are otherwise, you know, support the environment and the right of ants and dolphins and all kinds of causes. Not that I have anything against dolphins, but you would expect humans to deserve equal treatment to dolphins. So the BDS call addresses the three basic rights of the three main segments of the Palestinian people. ending the occupation of 1967, ending the system of racial discrimination inside Israel against its own Palestinian citizens, the indigenous Palestinians, and most importantly, the right of return of refugees in accordance with UN Resolution 194. Now, the second demand has been the most controversial in the BDS call. Many liberal Zionists jumped at it and said, but you're asking for full equality in Israel. Aren't you really intending to destroy Israel? Isn't that the point? You want to destroy Israel. I was actually asked that question at the University of Manchester in the UK by an ultra-right-wing Zionist. And I told him, what do you mean? Full equality destroys Israel? What does that say about Israel? If any system is destroyed when you have full equality, did full equality destroy South Africa? Did full equality destroy the southern states in the United States when segregation was ended? At least by law, it was ended. So equality never destroys people. It never destroys their existence. It destroys a racist system. So that's exactly what we're targeting. In the same vein, all the arguments against BDS being accused of wanting to delegitimize Israel, what does that mean exactly? I mean, why is the divestment from Sudan not delegitimizing Sudan? It's delegitimizing Sudan's oppression in Darfur and war crimes in Darfur. And every other boycott and every other divestment campaign had a clear target. It's only when it comes to Israel where this delegitimization of the state comes up as if it's a unique case in history, outside of history, in fact. But despite that, what's this charge of apartheid, which I mentioned earlier? The system of racial discrimination that Israel practices within the state itself constitutes apartheid. Many have spoken about Israel practicing apartheid in the occupied territories. Professor John Dugard, international law expert, Richard Folk, many Israeli ministers, members of Knesset, Sholomit Aloni, many have accused Israel of practicing apartheid within the occupied territories. In fact, an Israeli attorney general, Michael Ben-Yair, wrote in 2002, "We enthusiastically chose to become a colonial society, ignoring international treaties, expropriating lands, transferring settlers from Israel to the occupied territories, engaging in theft, and finding justification for all these activities. In effect," he says, "we established an apartheid regime in the occupied territories." So this is not very controversial, that Israel in the occupied territories is practicing apartheid. A South African study by the Human Sciences Research Center that was supervised by John Dugard reached that same conclusion, that Israel is practicing occupation, colonialism, as well as apartheid. But when it comes to Israel itself, not the occupied territories, that's when the controversy comes up. Are you comparing Israel with South Africa? Are you saying Israel is identical to South Africa, despite all the differences and the fact that Palestinians can vote in Israel and so on? Apartheid is not a matter of opinion, actually. So we don't care what Zionists think. It's irrelevant. There are objective criteria in international law. There's a UN Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, and the 2002 Rome Statute on the International Criminal Court that define the crime of apartheid. I'll just read very quickly some of that definition. The UN Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid describes the purpose of apartheid is establishing and maintaining domination by one racial group of persons over any other racial group of persons and systematically oppressing them, in particular by means such as segregation, expropriation of land, and denial of the right to leave and return to their country, the right to a nationality, and the right to freedom of movement and residence. End of quote. Israel fits the bill exactly. In the 2002 Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, the crime of apartheid is further defined as inhumane acts committed in the context of an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over other racial group or groups and committed with the intention of maintaining that regime. Again, fits the bill. Nothing there that it has to be identical to South Africa. It does not have to be. There are many examples of Israeli apartheid. I'll just give a couple in the interest of time. The nationality and citizenship, two-tiered system in Israel. Israel is the only country on earth that maintains a system of citizenship and nationality that are not the same. If you're a citizen, you're not necessarily a national. To become a national of the state of Israel, you have to be Jewish. Non-Jews who are born in Israel and lived there all their lives are never nationals of the state. In fact, some liberal Zionists went as far as the Supreme Court to challenge that, to try to strike from their IDs their identification of nationality. They had Jews under nationality, and they wanted to be identified as Israelis, not as Jews. And the Supreme Court rejected that. So it's rejected by the Knesset, by the Supreme Court. The entire establishment rejects that. So Israel is the only country that does not recognize its own nationality because it defines itself as a state of the Jewish people, the Jewish nation, whatever that abstract term means. The point is, if Israel were to recognize an Israeli nationality, it would immediately equate between Jews and non-Jews. And that would end the apartheid nature of Israel. So Zionists wouldn't want that, obviously. And there are many, many other examples, the most important of which is land ownership. Palestinians in Israel cannot own land on 93% of the area of the state land of Israel through many, many measures, the Jewish National Fund being one, but the Israeli Land Administration is also another very important tool of enforcing that effective measure against Palestinian ownership. But while there's so much discussion and debate about Israeli apartheid, some liberal Zionists started talking about fascism in Israel. So while this discussion about apartheid is ongoing, within so-called liberal Zionist circles inside Israel, there's increasing discussion about the rise of fascism. This especially came to the fore after the passage of the loyalty oath. According to this loyalty oath, non-Jews applying for Israeli citizenship would have to pledge allegiance to Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. Jews applying do not have to, because many ultra-Orthodox sects do not recognize Israel as a Jewish state for religious reasons. So they don't make them take that allegiance. It's only for non-Jews, i.e. Palestinians. After that loyalty oath, some liberal Zionist thinkers, intellectuals, artists started talking about the rise of fascism in Israel. In fact, they issued a declaration of independence from fascism, which more than 150 major figures in Israel signed on to. One particularly important figure, award-winning academic Gavriel Solomon, went as far as comparing today's Israel to Germany in the 1930s. He said, quote, "The idea of Judenrein, a Jew-free zone, or Arab Rhine is not new. Some might say, how can you compare us to Nazis? And he says, I'm not talking about the death camps, but about the year 1935. There were no camps yet, but there were racist laws. And we are heading forward toward these kinds of laws. The government is clearly declaring our incapacity for democracy." End of quote. Another very well-known writer, Sefi Rachlevsky, differed just on the time frame of that comparison. He wrote, quote, "The struggle today is not between left and right, but between Democrats and fascists. Israel is becoming fascist and racist. In a sense, you could say we're more like not the madness that was in Germany in 1933, but in 1944-45. When they were in danger of losing the war, the Germans, that is, madness prevented them from stopping." End of quote. So I don't think you'll see much of that debate in Israeli mainstream media, in U.S. mainstream media. In Israel, this is in Yedioth Ahronot, in Haaretz, in Jerusalem Post. In the mainstream, you're hearing those voices accusing the establishment of becoming fascist. I think it's an exaggeration, personally. But, you know, liberal Zionists, when they get mad, they can really exaggerate. But the point is, because it's targeting them, finally. I mean, all what Israel has done for the Palestinians, 6 decades of ethnic cleansing, of massacres, of siege, of slow death in Gaza, is not that problematic. But some veneer of democracy is falling off Israel's face, and they go nuts. How can we face our colleagues in the States and in Europe? We will look like some third world dictatorship or some fascist regime. That's so embarrassing to them. I mean, for their ego, it's horrific. We have to be sensitive to their ego. The other issue that always comes up when we discuss BDS is anti-Semitism. And I'm starting with the context rather than talking a lot about BDS, because most of it is in the book. And I have no shame in promoting the book, because all the proceeds, author's proceeds, are going to PACB, not to myself. So please buy the book. So you'll see all the discussion about the movement and the achievements and so on in the book. I'll go over that very shortly. But I want to discuss the issue of anti-Semitism, which I think is extremely important, especially in this country, because for some reason it maintains its effectiveness in deterring people from dissenting, from critiquing, from standing out of the line. Until now, it has this enormous potency that it has lost in many places, like Britain, for example, where it's meaningless when you attack a Jewish critic of Israel as a self-hating Jew. No one is deterred by that. But here in the US, it still carries a lot of weight. Clearly, it's not working with everyone, but it's still very effective, I think. So let's discuss that. Archbishop Desmond Tutu said, in this context of the anti-Semitism smear, "I think the West, quite rightly, is feeling contrite, penitent, for its awful connivance with the Holocaust. The penance is being paid by the Palestinians," he says. "I just hope again that ordinary citizens in the West will wake up and say, we refuse to be part of this." End of quote. Recently, a very senior Israeli diplomat, Ilan Baruch, quit the diplomatic corps in Israel, and he is a very important figure in the diplomatic corps. He had served many assignments, the last being ambassador to South Africa. He quit because he can no longer support the policy of the State of Israel. But regarding anti-Semitism specifically, he says, "Identifying the objection expressed by global public opinion to the occupation policy as anti-Semitic is simplistic, provincial, and artificial." End of quote. I love this provincial. You know, it's classy. And another very important figure, Avraham Burg, who's one of the leading Zionist figures in the last half century, I would say. He was the leader of the Knesset, the speaker of the Knesset for a long period. He was the head of the Jewish agency for a long period. So not exactly this your typical anti-Zionist, self-hating Jew. Avraham Burg had this to say, just to give some context, and then I'll move to his comments on the anti-Semitism issue, about his assessment of Israel in general. He says, "From this point, the establishment of the State of Israel not only failed to solve the problems for the sake of which it was founded, but on the contrary, made them a great deal worse. Israel," Burg says, "is the biggest shtetl in the history of the world. One big town around which walls of segregation and resentment rise higher every day, cutting it off from its surroundings. Few of us know any other existential reality apart from our unrelenting war with everyone all the time and over all issues." End of quote. Regarding the anti-Semitism issue, Burke says, "Israel sweeps all the criticism against it, both justified and unjustified, under the same anti-Semitic rug. It is actually we, Israelis that is, who are repeatedly mixing up proper criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. The reason is to avoid at any price having to confront the situation and make tough existential decisions. The occupation, the injustices, the discrimination, the persecution of the non-Jewish minority in our midst. So far," Burke says, "this has been enough to go on posturing against the world, based on a paradigm as addictive as it is erroneous, that the whole world is against us. It is a historical, moral, and emotional checking account that is suffering from being overextended and is on the brink of being closed. There's no other country in the Western world," he says, "from which the international community has been willing to put up with acts of state violence for 5 decades other than Israel. There's no other country that's permitted by the international community to maintain a vast, unsupervised nuclear arsenal other than Israel. And there's no other colonialist left in the world other than the only democracy in the Middle East. The world is still putting up with all this," he says, "but not for much longer. It will soon be over." So what Burg is describing is really the loss of the hearts and minds that we're seeing all over the place. A recent BBC poll shows that among Europeans, Israel is viewed as competing with Iran, North Korea, and Pakistan over who's the biggest menace to world security. So that's the camp where Europeans are increasingly viewing Israel in. Thus, BDS has grown tremendously. This is the context that explains why BDS has grown tremendously. It's not just because it's supported by the great majority of Palestinian civil society. It's not just because it's based on international law and human rights, universal human rights, and is opposed to all forms of racism, including anti-Semitism. It's not just because we have partners even in Israel and everywhere else. It's growing in the global south, in the west, and so on. It's also because we have to give credit where credit belongs. The right, fanatic right-wing government of Israel has really helped. I mean, if we had a different, slightly liberal government, it would have taken us much longer. So when we started BDS in 2005, we had no idea we would be here at this point. Less than 6 years later, that we would have major trade union federations in South Africa, in Scotland, in Ireland, in Canada, in France, in Belgium, in all over, in Brazil, in India, that we'd have such a massive support from trade unions. Last year, after the flotilla attack, the Palestinian BDS National Committee, which is the BNC, the leadership of the global BDS movement, which is a huge coalition of Palestinian civil society groups, called on dock workers' unions to block Israeli ships, not to load or offload Israeli ships as a protest to the flotilla attack. This was heeded by the Swedish Dock Workers Union. The Norwegians initially started but retracted. Indian Dock Workers Union in Cochin, the fourth largest port in India. Turkish and even US Dock Workers Union in Oakland, California, observed it for 24 hours, and that is really appreciated. Quickly on the economic level, because many people say, okay, at the cultural level we can see the Pixies, Costello, you know, all these great names boycotting Israel all of a sudden, or at least heeding the Palestinian call not to perform in Israel. Increasingly, this is becoming a very serious threat to Israel, that it's all the millions and tens of millions of dollars it's spent on the Brand Israel campaign to rebrand itself, to show itself as a state of high technology and fine arts and so on, has really failed. And many artists are not buying it, and they're not going to Israel. They're realizing that Tel Aviv today looks very much like Sun City did during apartheid South Africa. But at the economic level, it always comes up, will this have any impact on Israel? Because Israel is a large economy. It's a very powerful economy. And it does produce so many things. It has so much trade. It's very integrated into the world economy. So can BDS have any hope? Because people will not join a movement that doesn't look very hopeful. Despite their moral convictions and so on, they'd rather spend their energy on something that has hope to achieve results. Well, BDS does not have hope. It is already achieving results. I'll just give one quick example on the economic side. Veolia, a French conglomerate involved in the Jerusalem Light Rail, it's a tramway that connects Israeli settlements, illegal settlements in the occupied territories with the city of Jerusalem. So 100% illegal project. In 2008, we launched a campaign from Bilbao in the Basque Country, Spain. We launched a campaign, Palestinian, Israeli, and European civil society organizations, to boycott Veolia, to deny Veolia contracts wherever it's operating due to its involvement in the Jerusalem Light Rail. And we threatened Veolia that you will lose a lot of money if you do not withdraw from this project. But of course, we were posturing. I mean, we had no idea we could do that. It's a huge company working in some 50 countries with tens of billions of dollars of revenues, and we're a tiny civil society movement that's still growing. But less than 2 years later, Veolia had lost to the tune of $10 billion worth of contracts, mainly due to the BDS movement. Just before I came on this tour to the United States, news came from London that the City Council of South London excluded Veolia from a contract worth £1 billion. So that's to be added to the tally. And in many of those campaigns, the beauty of the BDS campaign is that it's based on individuals, citizens, civil society groups of all sorts, very diverse, committed to equal rights, committed to, that still believe in that old-fashioned concept of universal law and universal human rights, and that international law should apply to everyone and all humans are born equal. You know, those old-fashioned things. Though people who believe in that and start campaigns, very innovative, creative campaigns. So sometimes it takes five committed individuals in some city council in Ireland to achieve a major results such as excluding Veolia from the metro or the water sanitation contract of that city council that's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And it really, we have so many success stories of very few individuals doing massive work. Here in Boston, and I always use the Boston example, the Science Museum, some people here were very involved in that. That was a classic example of a BDS campaign, very creative, very innovative, where you know they had this kind of guide taking students supposedly to the museum to show them the museum, and they were talking about Israel's crimes and violations of international law and using very creative techniques to educate and to push for divestment and boycott. Another very creative example that I always like to cite is in Britain. Again, Britain has a lot of creative examples on BDS. They were at the forefront of the movement. An Israeli music group funded by the government was touring, part of Brand Israel campaign, was playing in London, and it was broadcast, or at least in England, I'm not sure which city, it was broadcast on BBC Three, the main radio station, live. So the BDS activists came up with this idea. I mean, protesting, carrying signs wouldn't cut it. It would look like, you know, you're out of tune, basically. They're playing Beethoven and so on, and you're shouting. So what they did is they had a soprano, a singer, who went in, and she interrupted by singing opera. End the occupation, end Israeli occupation, in this beautiful voice. And it was carried on BBC Live because they couldn't. So they had to cut the broadcast. But there was so much controversy, and everyone was calling into BBC, what was that? That they had to interview the singer and the orchestra and, you know, have this debate between them. Why did you do this? Why did you interrupt them? So she explained about Brand Israel and how musicians and artists are used by the State of Israel to whitewash its crimes. So it was an excellent educational opportunity and a wonderful BDS campaign. What I wanted to say is that there's so much energy, there's so much creativity in this movement, and I think this book is a product of that. It is not my book as such, yes, I wrote it, but it's the movement's book. It's about our achievements, our collective achievements, from Boston to Johannesburg to Delhi to Stockholm. Really, London, of course. Shouldn't forget London. It's that collective effort by this global movement that's not centralized, that's not dogmatic, that's not a political party. It's a true, living, moving, growing, evolving movement where there's a lot of autonomy, a lot of creativity. Just to end, I'll quote Edward Said, and I'll come to the very end. Edward Said said, "Nothing in my mind is more reprehensible than those habits of mind in the intellectual that induce avoidance. That characteristic turning away from a difficult and principled position, which you know to be the right one, but which you decide not to take. You do not want to appear too political. You're afraid of seeming controversial. You want to keep a reputation for being balanced, objective, moderate. Your hope is to be asked back, to consult, to be on a board of a prestigious committee, and so to remain within the responsible mainstream." Edward Said goes on to say, "For an intellectual, these habits of mind are corrupting par excellence. If anything can denature, neutralize, and finally kill a passionate intellectual life, it's the internalization of such habits. Personally," he says, I've encountered them in one of the toughest of all contemporary issues, Palestine, where fear of speaking out about one of the greatest injustices in modern history has hobbled, blinkered, muzzled many who know the truth and are in a position to serve it. For despite the abuse and vilification that any outspoken supporter of Palestinian rights and self-determination earns for him or herself, the truth deserves to be spoken, represented by an unafraid and compassionate intellectual." End of quote. I hope that this book is an attempt to heed Edward Said's appeal. Thank you.
And that, brothers and sisters, was a talk given by Omar Barghouti a week or so ago at Harvard University, as you could tell. And it was actually part of a book tour. It was April 13th was the date. It really was worth attending. I was even there myself. That's not my recording. It's a recording, I believe, that was made by David Goodman. And we have to thank him very, very much for it. And that's it for today for This Week in Palestine. In the meantime, whisper, talk, or scream, but do not remain silent. Thank you for listening. Have a great day this Easter. And until next time, please take good care of our world and of yourselves. تسكنون